If you're anything like me, you probably learned in high school biology that your DNA is, well, it's a rigid blueprint.
Right, like a master computer program.
Exactly. A program that tells your cells exactly how to build your body, like exactly where to put your eyes, how long to make your arms, you know, how to wire up your brain.
It's a very mechanical view of life.
It is. And honestly, it's comforting. It's binary. You have the genes for a trait or you don't. The instructions are just locked away in the nucleus of your cells.
Yeah, that's the standard model we've all been taught for decades.
Right. But, and this is why we're here today, what if that's entirely backwards?
Well, the data is certainly suggesting it might be.
Because in a lab in Massachusetts, scientists took a tiny flatworm, chopped it entirely in half, and without touching a single letter of its DNA, forced that worm to grow a second head instead of a tail.
Which is just, it's staggering when you really think about it.
It fundamentally broke the blueprint.
It really is a profoundly unsettling experiment if you're holding on to that classical genetic-centric worldview. I mean, we are so accustomed to thinking of the genome as the ultimate architect of life.
Right, the boss giving all the orders.
Exactly. But when you actually start looking at the mechanics of how a body is built, you know, how cells actually communicate and organize in three-dimensional space, that architectural certainty just dissolves.
Just vanishes.
It does. You realize we have spent the last 70 years confusing the list of building materials with the builder itself.
Okay, let's unpack this, because untangling that confusion is exactly the mission of today's deep dive. We are examining this mind-bending 2026 paper by C.F. Dietz.
Titled The Grammar of Form,
Right.
yes.
And what Dietz does here is he takes the groundbreaking experimental work of Tufts University biologist Michael Levin and analyzes it through this philosophical lens called the closure framework.
And we really need to emphasize the stakes here. We are looking at experiments that completely redefine what intelligence and agency actually mean in biology.
It's massive.
We're going to explore how cells collectively build bodies they have never even seen without changing a single line of genetic code.
So to truly grasp how radical this is, we can't just jump into the philosophy. We have to start with the physical evidence, right? The worm.
Yes, the planarian flatworm. It is the perfect entry point.
Because if DNA is the blueprint, this worm just burns the blueprint to the ground.
It really does. It's one of biology's ultimate mysteries. If you want to understand how a body knows what shape it is supposed to be, you have to look at an organism that can effortlessly rebuild its shape from almost total destruction.
And these things are tiny, right? They live in freshwater.
Yeah, tiny freshwater worms,
Yeah.
but their regenerative capacity borders on the miraculous.
Because, I mean, if you cut a human, we patch it with scar tissue. If you cut an earthworm, it might survive, but it's not doing magic. What happens when you slice a planarian?
Well, it's far beyond simple patching. If you take a scalpel and cut a planarian crosswise, so literally chop it in half across its midsection, the front piece with the head will seamlessly grow a new tail. And the back piece, the one with the old tail, will grow a perfectly proportioned new head.
Which is already wild. I mean, the tissue at the cut site somehow knows whether it's facing forward or backward.
Exactly, it knows what's missing. But the geometry gets even stranger. If you cut the worm lengthwise, right down the middle from head to tail, the left half grows a new right half, and the right half grows a new left half.
Both just become complete worms.
Complete bilateral worms. You can even cut them into fragments, sometimes hundreds of tiny pieces.
Wait, hundreds?
Yes. And no matter how you fragment it, each piece somehow knows exactly what kind of worm it should become. It builds exactly that shape, correct proportions, internal organs, nervous system, everything.
So the high school biology answer is just, well, the DNA in those cells tells it to do that.
Right. But when you look closer, that logic completely breaks down. The genome absolutely encodes the molecular components.
Proteins and stuff.
Right. The recipes for the proteins, the structural materials. But the genome does not encode the head-to-tail ratio. It doesn't encode the precise placement of the organs.
So there's no 3D map in the DNA.
None at all. If you sequence the DNA, the spatial map is missing. So the DNA isn't holding the blueprint for the shape. Something else must be carrying that morphogenetic goal.
Something is telling the cells, okay, stop dividing now. The head is finished.
Exactly. And this is where Michael Levin's team at Tufts comes into the picture. They wanted to find that something else. And it turns out the secret isn't chemical, it's electrical.
Okay, electrical. How does that work in a worm?
Well, every living cell has ion channels embedded in its membrane. They're like tiny protein gates that selectively let charged particles like sodium, potassium, calcium flow in and out.
So by moving those positive and negative charges around, the cell is acting like a microscopic battery.
A very precise, dynamic microscopic battery, yeah. Now, we usually associate this electrical activity with the brain.
Right, neurons firing.
Exactly. Neurons use ion channels to fire action potentials. That's how we think. But the crucial realization here is that ordinary, non-neural cells have these exact same ion channels.
Skin cells, gut cells, whatever.
Right. And they don't just sit there in isolation. These cells connect to each other through physical tunnels called gap junctions.
Meaning they can pass that electrical charge directly to their neighbors?
Yes. And because they're passing these ions back and forth, they establish complex, stable electrical states that propagate across entire collectives of cells.
Like a whole sheet of tissue develops an electrical pattern.
Exactly, a specific electrical topography. So Levin's team mapped this in the planarian, and then they intervened. They used specific drugs to block certain ion channels.
Disrupting the bioelectric pattern?
Disrupting the pattern that normally spreads across the worm's body.
Okay, and I want to make sure the core of this experiment is crystal clear for you listening. When they blocked those channels, they did not touch the DNA.
Zero genetic modification. The genome was exactly the same. The molecular building blocks were the same. All they did was scramble the electrical communication at the cut site.
And the result.
When those severed fragments started to regenerate, they didn't build a normal worm. They built a two-headed worm.
A head at the front, a head at the back.
Fully functional heads on both ends and absolutely no tail.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Because you might think, okay, you dumped chemicals on them, poisoned them, so they grew into freaks. But it wasn't just a glitch, right?
Not at all. And this is where the implications get massive. Months later, long after the disruption was flushed out of their systems, those worms were cut again.
Yeah.
They continued regenerating as two-headed worms.
Wow.
Even though no genetic change had ever occurred, the memory of the new shape was stored in the bioelectric network.
That is insane. But the twist that really shakes the foundation of this whole biological determinism thing, Levin's team went a step further. They didn't just scramble the signal, they actively rewrote it.
Yes, and this part of Dietz's paper genuinely feels like science fiction.
It really does. Tell them what they did.
By applying specific, targeted bioelectric signals to the planarian tissue, Levin's team induced the worms to grow the heads of entirely different planarian species.
Wait, they made a flatworm grow the head of a different evolutionary species, like different brain shape, different stem cells.
Completely different head morphology.
Yeah.
And again, without altering a single letter of its genetic code.
The cells had never seen the DNA for that other head shape.
Never. Their DNA was entirely standard for their own species. Yet when the bioelectric memory in the tissue was rewritten to match the target electrical state of that different form, the cells built it perfectly.
Okay, my brain is short-circuiting a bit here. If the DNA isn't the blueprint, what is it? Let me try to map this out with an analogy.
Go for it.
Is DNA just a hardware store full of parts? Like, it's the molecular toolkit, it provides the lumber, the nails, the pipes. But the bioelectric pattern is the actual architect who walks into the store carrying the blueprint and decides what actually gets built out of those materials.
That is a remarkably precise way to visualize it.
Mm.
The genome is the hardware store.
Yep.
It provides the inventory. But the bioelectric pattern is a higher level organizational system.
Dietz calls it a higher level organizational closure, right?
Yes. It dictates how that toolkit is deployed in space and in time.
So the architect can walk into the exact same hardware store with the exact same nails and wood and choose to build a house or a boat or a shed strictly depending on the blueprint they brought with them.
Exactly. Changing the bioelectric pattern while leaving the genome intact is like handing the architect a completely new set of blueprints while they are standing in the middle of the same hardware store.
The materials they pull off the shelves are identical.
Identical. But the final form constructed is completely different. And this brings us directly to a fundamental concept championed by the renowned systems biologist Dennis Noble, called downward causation.
Right, because the traditional view of biology, the one I definitely learned, is strictly upward causation, like genes make proteins, proteins make cells.
Cells group into tissues. Tissues magically form bodies. Everything is dictated from the microscopic level upward. But Levin's planarians demonstrate massive, undeniable downward causation.
The whole dictates the parts.
Exactly. The macro-level bioelectric pattern, the state of the whole tissue, sets the boundary conditions that dictate what the micro-level molecules actually do. The overarching electrical pattern reaches downward and forces the cells to deploy their toolkit to build a specific shape.
Okay, so if DNA isn't a strict computer program executing a blind script, what exactly are the cells doing when they grow? How does this invisible electrical architect actually communicate with the lumber and the nails?
Levin outlines this mechanism in his first major claim. Bioelectricity acts as the cognitive glue.
The cognitive glue.
Right. We touched on the ion channels and gap junctions, but it's worth exploring how this fundamentally changes a cell's identity. When cells connect their gap junctions, they aren't just sharing ions.
What are they sharing?
They are sharing their internal states. They merge their individual electrical boundaries into a unified tissue-wide boundary.
Which brings us back to the brain connection. Because neurons do exactly this, right?
They do.
They use bioelectricity to process info, hold memories, and produce behavior in physical space. When I reach out and grab my coffee mug, that is a bioelectric network moving my arm in 3D space.
What's fascinating here is that Levin argues, and the data supports this, that the brain didn't invent this trick.
Oh, really?
Evolution is incredibly conservative. Long before brains or neurons existed, ordinary non-neural cells were using that exact same bioelectric machinery.
But not to move muscles.
Right. Instead of producing behavior in physical space, they use it to produce form in anatomical morphospace. Same machinery, different problem space.
So the brain navigates physical space. The body tissue navigates morphospace, the mathematical space of all possible body shapes.
Precisely. And this leads directly to Levin's second major claim. Morphogenesis, the generation of biological form, is not a program. It is goal-directed navigation.
I really want to unpack the difference between a program and goal-directed navigation because it feels like the crux of everything.
Yeah.
A program is rigid, right? Like a baking recipe.
Yes, very rigid.
You add flour, add sugar, bake for 20 minutes. If you accidentally drop a rock into the bowl, the recipe doesn't care. It has no awareness of the rock. It just bakes the rock.
Right. A program executes its steps regardless of the changing environment. But goal-directed navigation is entirely different.
It's like a GPS.
Exactly like a GPS.
Yeah.
You input a destination, the goal. The GPS plots a route. If a road is suddenly closed, the GPS doesn't just stubbornly drive you into a barricade.
He recalculates.
He evaluates its current position relative to the goal, and it generates a new path to get you to that exact same destination.
And Levin proves that body tissues act like the GPS, not the recipe.
He absolutely falsifies the blind recipe view. And he does it most elegantly, not with worms, but with the Mexican axolotl salamander.
Ah, the salamander. They're famous for regenerating, right?
Yes. If you amputate a salamander's limb at the shoulder, it doesn't just blindly run a make an arm script from a hard drive. It evaluates exactly what is missing.
It figures out its current location on the map.
Right. It begins producing the humerus, the radius, the ulna, the complex musculature. And then crucially, it stops.
That is the part that is so easy to overlook. The fact that it stops, it knows when the job is done.
It stops exactly when the correct limb is achieved. And if you amputate the limb at the wrist instead of the shoulder, it doesn't grow a whole new arm from the shoulder down. It just grows the hand.
Meaning the tissue must know what a correct, complete limb looks like.
And it must be able to continuously evaluate its current damaged state against that target.
So mechanically, how is that happening? How does a stump of tissue measure the difference between itself and a full hand?
In cybernetics, this mechanism is called a test operant exit loop, TOE.
Like a thermostat.
Exactly like a thermostat. You set the target to 70 degrees. That's the goal. The thermostat tests the current air temperature. If it's 65, it operates, it turns on the furnace.
It keeps testing 66, 67, 68.
And the moment the current state matches the target state, it exits the loop. It turns the furnace off.
So the salamander's tissue has a biological thermostat, but for its 3D shape.
Exactly. The tissue stores the target morphology, the blueprint of the intact limb in its bioelectric memory. It is constantly measuring its current physical state against this target electrical state.
And if there's a huge mismatch, like the limb just got bitten off.
The error signal is huge. So the cells operate. They divide, migrate, change cell type, all to minimize the distance between the damaged state and the target state. When the hand is finished, the error signal drops to zero and they exit the loop. They stop dividing.
Think about this for your own body, you know, listening to this. Your body's cells are constantly talking electrically to maintain your physical shape. It's anatomical homeostasis.
Yeah. My face is constantly running that test operant exit loop.
Yeah.
Just to stay looking like my face. My liver is running it to stay a liver. It's an active, ongoing intelligence preventing us from just dissolving into a shapeless mass.
And that word intelligence is heavily loaded, but it is technically accurate here, because if a tissue has goals, if it can navigate a complex problem space, recalculate around obstacles, we have to confront what that actually means for our definitions of agency.
Right, because usually we reserve the word agent for things with brains. A dog is an agent. A human is an agent. But Levin is scaling this way, way down. He introduces a framework called TAME, right?
Yes, TAME, the technological approach to mind everywhere.
Catch it.
It's a brilliant conceptual tool because it forces biology to address a question it usually avoids. What exactly constitutes an agent? And how does agency scale up from a single cell to a human?
So how does TAME define agency at its lowest level? At its most minimal biological level, agency is exactly what we just discussed, homeostasis. The ability to maintain a set point, measure the current state against it, and act to reduce the difference.
So under that definition, a single cell has a tiny bit of agency.
Yes. And this is where Levin uses the concept of the cognitive light cone.
Like in physics.
Just like in physics, where a light cone defines the boundary of what an event can affect, limited by the speed of light. Levin borrows this to describe the scale of an agent's goals. Basically, what is the size of the world it cares about, and how far into the future can it act?
So a single cell's light cone?
Is microscopic.
Yeah.
Its goals operate on a spatial scale of micrometers, and a temporal scale of maybe seconds or minutes.
It just cares about balancing its own internal chemistry, keeping toxic molecules out, nutrients in. It has no concept of anything beyond its own membrane.
Exactly. But when you couple those single cells together into a bioelectric network using gap junctions, they share information.
They blur their individual boundaries.
They do. And now they can pursue goals that are entirely invisible to a single cell. A tissue's cognitive light cone spans millimeters or even centimeters, and operates over hours or days.
So a single skin cell has no idea what a finger is.
It cannot conceptualize a finger, but a bioelectrically bound collective of millions of skin, bone, and nerve cells does. The network can pursue the goal of building a finger.
And then you scale it up again?
Scale it up to a central nervous system, a brain. Now, the cognitive light cone is immense. It spans meters physically and decades temporally. Because your neurons are coupled, you can plan for retirement.
A single cell cannot plan for retirement.
A liver cannot plan for retirement.
Mm.
But the fundamental mechanism coupling lower-level agents into a higher-level collective to pursue larger goals is exactly the same.
Okay, I have to push back here because this is where the language gets very tricky. So, the listener might be wondering, are you saying my kidney is conscious? Does my liver have anxiety about processing too much alcohol? Because that sounds like mysticism.
It is a vital clarification to make. Levin is exceptionally careful here. We have to separate intelligence and agency from consciousness. In the TAME framework, intelligence and agency absolutely do not require consciousness.
They just require the mechanical ability to solve problems.
Exactly. Your liver is a highly intelligent, competent agent in anatomical space. It can heal itself, adapt to metabolic loads. It has a target state. But there's no evidence that it feels what it is doing.
There's no inner subjective experience.
None. Evolution has simply found a deeply efficient trick, repeatedly coupling non-conscious lower-level agents into higher-level collectives that can pursue bigger goals. The intelligence is undeniably real, but your kidney isn't pondering its own existence.
Okay, that makes sense. It's a mechanical problem-solving intelligence. But accepting that this intelligence exists brings us to this frankly thrilling realization. If this electrical network is what dictates the form of biological matter, what happens when humans figure out how to plug a keyboard into it?
This is the fourth major claim in Levin's work, and it is arguably the most consequential for the future of medicine. He calls this hypothetical interface the anatomical compiler.
Let's use a software analogy here because I think it perfectly captures the leap we're talking about. In the early days of computing, if you wanted to write a program, you had to write machine code, ones and zeros.
Micromanaging the hardware switches.
Brutally difficult. In biology, trying to alter a body by editing specific genes is exactly like writing machine code. It's incredibly hard to predict how changing one microscopic gene will ripple up to affect the final 3D body.
But an anatomical compiler operates like a modern high-level programming language, like Python. When a programmer uses Python, they don't tell the computer exactly which microtransistors to flip. They just write a high-level command. Draw a red circle.
And the compiler, the translator, takes that high-level goal and automatically figures out the low-level machine code required to execute it on that specific hardware.
So Levin's vision is a biological compiler. Instead of writing genetic machine code, we write our goals in the high-level language of bioelectric patterns.
We literally input a command into the tissue that says, build a leg right here.
And the compiler translates that bioelectric command so the cells can figure out the low-level implementation themselves. We don't need to know which proteins to synthesize. The cells already know how to do that. We just give them the right macro blueprint.
And we should emphasize, this is not speculative sci-fi. Dietz's paper details three massive real-world demonstrations from Levin's lab that show this compiler-like interaction is already happening.
Yes, let's go through them. The first is their work on cancer, which frankly flips the entire paradigm of oncology upside down.
Wait, if tissues are just networks telling individual cells what to do, what happens when a cell just stops listening? Is that what cancer is? A cell unplugging from the network?
That is exactly Levin's premise. Mm. Typically, the medical establishment views cancer strictly as a genetic disease.
Mm.
DNA mutations accumulate, cells multiply out of control.
Right.
But from Levin's bioelectric perspective, the genetic mutation is secondary to a breakdown in the cognitive glue. The cells essentially sever their gap junction connections.
They lose their link to the tissue level network.
And when they do that, they shrink their cognitive light cone all the way back down to the single cell level. They forget they are part of a liver or a lung. And because they no longer receive the overarching command to be a liver, they revert to their ancient default behavior.
Which is?
They behave like single celled amoebas, selfishly dividing and migrating wherever they want.
But if they're just unplugged, using the compiler logic, couldn't you just plug them back in?
And that is exactly what Levin's team did. They have shown in living models that by using specific bioelectric signals, altering the voltage gradients around tumors, you can force those rogue cells to plug back into the network.
You impose the normal tissue level goals onto them electrically?
Exactly. And when you do, even if those cells still possess wildly mutated cancerous genetics, they stop behaving as tumors. They go back to integrating as normal tissue. The high-level bioelectric command overrides the corrupted genetic hardware.
That is staggering. The software overrides the broken hardware. Okay, what's proof number two?
Limb regeneration in animals that normally can't regenerate, like adult frogs.
Because salamanders can, but frogs can't, right?
Exactly. If an adult frog loses a leg, it just scars over, much like a human. But Levin's team used a wearable device, a bioreactor, to apply a specific bioelectric cocktail to the amputation site of an adult frog.
They were writing the high-level command, build a limb, into the tissue's memory.
Yes, and they triggered the cells to autonomously orchestrate the entire process. They didn't micromanage the bone growth or the nerve routing. They just pushed the bioelectric start button, and the cells built a highly complex functional new leg.
Okay, proof number three. This is the one that forces us to question what an organism even is. The xenobots.
The xenobots.
This sounds like tiny alien terminators. What exactly are they?
They are entirely biological, but entirely synthetic. Levin's team took living skin cells from the embryo of a frog. They mechanically separated these cells, freeing them from their normal bioelectric context within the embryo.
They stripped away the instruction that told them to be frog skin.
Then they placed these cells together in a novel environment, a petri dish, allowing them to spontaneously form a new bioelectric network from scratch.
Okay, wait. If they are frog skin cells, shouldn't they just grow into a flat sheet of skin at the bottom of the dish? Or just a chaotic tumor?
That is what the classical genetic model would predict. But that's not what happened. Because they formed a new bioelectric network, they established a new macro-level goal. They spontaneously self-organized into synthetic living machines, forms no frog has ever taken in evolutionary history.
Wow.
They formed little spherical bodies. They repurposed the microscopic hair-like structures on their surface cilia, which normally just push mucus around on a frog's skin, and use them like little oars to swim around the dish.
They swim.
They navigate mazes. They spontaneously sweep up loose debris into piles. And if they are cut, they heal themselves perfectly.
So what does this all mean? They used frog molecular machinery, frog hardware, but navigated morphospace toward entirely novel, non-frog targets.
Precisely. They have the genome of a frog, but the anatomy and behavior of something entirely new.
So synthesizing this, the form of an organism is not permanently locked by its genetic hardware. The genome is just the raw clay. The bioelectric network is the sculptor's hands. If we can master this compiler, the possibilities for regenerative medicine are almost beyond comprehension.
It is a profound paradigm shift. But as Dietz argues in The Grammar of Form, there are major structural and philosophical gaps in Levin's framework that need to be closed. Levin shows us that this happens, but he doesn't fully provide the structural philosophy of why it is logically coherent.
And this brings us to the core of Dietz's contribution, the closure framework. He looks at Levin's xenobots and says, brilliant, but we have two massive philosophical gaps.
Yes. The first gap is structural. Levin shows that bioelectric coupling produces a new, higher-level agent. But why does joining them together produce a true higher-level entity with its own distinct goals, rather than just a really complicated clump of individual cells?
Right, like 10 people shouting in a room is a mob, not a unified agent. What turns the mob of frog cells into a xenobot?
Exactly. And the second gap is the one you intuitively pushed back on earlier. Where exactly does consciousness fit into this scaling of intelligence?
Right. At what specific point in the cognitive light cone does an agent wake up? So Dietz introduces the closure regime to solve this. What exactly is a closure regime, mechanically speaking?
Dietz defines a closure regime as a system that stabilizes specific reality by executing three distinct operations. It draws distinctions, it establishes identity criteria, and it maintains lawful relationships.
Okay, that's a bit abstract. Let's ground it using the bioelectric pattern as our example.
Perfect. The bioelectric pattern is a closure regime. First, it draws distinctions. It structurally defines the boundary between the electrical state of a head and a tail. It separates the biological world into distinct functional categories.
Step one, it creates categories.
Second, it establishes identity criteria.
Okay.
It sets the target pattern. It says for this mass of tissue to be considered a head, it must look exactly like this specific electrical signature. That sets the absolute standard for what constitutes success.
The target on the thermostat.
Exactly. And third, it maintains lawful relationships. It uses those gap junctions to enforce the rules. Mm. It ensures that if one cell's electrical state deviates, its neighbors pull it back into line.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we have to talk about remainder because I have an analogy for this.
Let's hear it.
It's like ordering a pizza at a restaurant. The closure regime is me interacting with the waiter. I draw a distinction. I want pizza, not pasta. I establish the identity criteria large, pepperoni. But the remainder is everything I leave outside of my control. I don't go into the kitchen and tell the chef exactly how many times to knead the dough or the geometric coordinates of each pepperoni. I leave the micro-execution to the kitchen. That micro-execution is the remainder.
That is an excellent analogy. Every closure regime generates a remainder. It inherently leaves a space of freedom for the lower levels.
Right.
In biology, the bioelectric pattern specifies the form macro shape of the salamander hand.
Mm-hmm.
But it leaves the exact molecular pathways as remainder. It doesn't micromanage the proteins as long as the final macro shape is achieved.
This connects perfectly back to the compiler. The Python code says, draw a circle. It leaves the switching of the millions of microscopic transistors as remainder.
Precisely. And this explains the immense robustness of biology. Different cells and different species might use entirely different molecular strategies to reach the exact same bioelectric goal. The higher level closure regime specifies the goal and uses the lower levels as its resource, its remainder, to get it done.
So synthesizing this for the listener, Dietz uses this term supersession. If I look down at a cut on my arm right now, supersession is exactly what I'm watching happen, right? My arm is actively closing the gap between the cut and the blueprint.
Yes. Supersession is the tissue essentially recognizing a violation of its identity. It says, my identity criterion dictates that I am a continuous layer of skin. My current state is a laceration. I have a massive remainder here, an arrow. I need to supersede this current state, update my structure, and satisfy the closure.
That explains the regenerating limb perfectly. It's continually superseding its damaged physical state until it perfectly matches its bioelectric identity.
It's incredibly elegant. And Dietz argues that this elegance isn't isolated just to Levin's lab. He argues that Levin is experimentally proving the theories of some of the greatest minds in biology and physics.
Let's break down these connections. First on Dietz's list, Dennis Noble and biological relativity. We touched on downward causation.
Yes. Dennis Noble is a titan in systems biology. His principle of biological relativity states there is no privileged level of causation in biology. For decades, genetics was the privileged level, the absolute bottom-up boss. Noble argued theoretically that higher levels, like tissues or organs, can cause concrete changes at the lower molecular levels.
And Levin just physically proves it. The bioelectric closure is causally prior to the molecular level. Changing the higher level changes the outcome without touching the genes.
Levin demonstrated Noble's downward causation with undeniable experimental precision.
Okay, the next theoretical heavy hitter, Carl Friston and the free energy principle. Friston's work is notoriously dense. How does the physics of free energy connect to a flatworm growing ahead?
Well, Friston's free energy principle is a mathematical framework describing how biological systems maintain their integrity by minimizing surprise. And by surprise, he means the difference between what the system expects to happen and what its sensors actually report is happening. The system minimizes the surprise through a process he calls active inference.
Let's ground active inference. If someone throws a baseball at my head, my brain predicts the path of the ball. The surprise would be the ball hitting me. So I actively infer I duck my head to make reality match my prediction of not getting hit.
A perfect physical example. Your brain minimizes the surprise by changing your physical state. Well, Dunce maps this directly onto morphogenesis. Levin's morphogenetic navigation, the tissue minimizing the distance between its amputated state and his target bioelectric state, is exactly Friston's active inference applied to anatomical space.
So the tissue is predicting what its shape should be and growing to make that prediction a reality.
Exactly, to minimize the anatomical surprise. The math mapping Friston's brain models and Levin's tissue models is identical. They even co-authored papers on this.
Okay, third thinker. Humberto Maturana and autopoiesis.
Maturana coined the term autopoiesis, self-creation, to describe how a single cell continually recreates its own components to maintain its identity against a chaotic environment. It's the ultimate cellular closure regime.
And Levin extends it upwards.
Right. Levin proves that tissues and whole organisms are also autopoietic. They self-create and self-maintain their macrostructures using bioelectric patterns, operating two distinct levels up from the single cell.
Just nested hierarchies of self-creation. Finally, Eva Jablonka and evolutionary inheritance.
Jablonka proposed that there are four dimensions of inheritance. Genetic, epigenetic, behavioral, and symbolic. Dietz points out that Levin's bioelectric patterns provide the physical mechanism for a massive, non-genetic inheritance system.
Because the flatworms remembered their new head shape months later.
Exactly. The patterns store memory, react to the environment, and dictate how genes are deployed. It's a powerful layer of evolutionary information operating above the genome.
I really want to emphasize how profound this is for you listening. You aren't just a meat machine reading a DNA script. You are a nested hierarchy of problem-solving intelligence, from your cells to your organs to your brain, all actively inferring and pursuing goals.
It completely replaces a cold, deterministic view of life with a deeply dynamic, cognitive one.
So what are the big takeaways today? Bodies don't execute programs. They navigate toward target morphogenetic memories. Bioelectricity is the compiler, and this structure, the grammar of form, is how higher-level closures specify what lower levels must build.
We have to remember the importance of critical thinking here. Rethinking fundamental assumptions like the supremacy of DNA opens up vast new horizons in biology, regenerative medicine, and our understanding of life itself.
Speaking of our understanding of life, I want to prompt you for one last mind-bender. We talked about Dietz's second gap regarding consciousness. Where is the line?
This raises an important question. Dietz mentions the difference between C lowercase c, which stands for organized content, and C uppercase C, which stands for conscious presence.
Uppercase C is the lights actually being on.
Right. Levin's morphogenetic agents, the xenobots, the regenerating limbs, they absolutely possess lowercase c. They have organized content, they pursue goals. But Dietz argues they do not have uppercase C. There's nothing it feels like to be a regenerating liver.
So where does uppercase C start?
Dietz points to Jablonka's threshold for C, unlimited associative learning. A system crosses this threshold when its internal closure regime becomes so sophisticated it can create complex, compound associations across vast stretches of time and space.
It can form concepts.
Yes. At this level of complexity, the system's closure becomes sophisticated enough to encounter its own remainder as something it feels rather than just data it processes. The sheer density of information forces the system to generate a unified, subjective model of itself and the world. It wakes up.
So I want to leave you with this to chew on. If we eventually use Levin's anatomical compiler to build synthetic organisms with increasingly complex bioelectric networks, at what point does that synthetic morphogenetic intelligence cross the threshold of unlimited associative learning? At what point does a tissue network stop just navigating anatomical space and actually wake up to feel itself doing it? Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the sources. Keep your own cognitive light tone expanding.